The world is supported by Wise, the smart new way to move money internationally. Imagine a world where you could speak any language, travel to any place, and spend in any currency with ease. At Wise, they're building the money part. Wise is the world's most international account. It lets you hold and convert dozens of currencies all in one place. And you always get the real exchange rate with no markups like the banks sometimes give you. So whether you're sending money to Australia, hopping on a plane to Poland, or getting paid from France, Wise is all you need. Designed by international people for international people. Try Wise for free at wise.com/world.
Since Haiti's president was assassinated, the security situation has only gotten worse, with rival gangs fighting over territory.
We have over 15,000 women and children who are forced to flee their home due to acts of violence.
Also on the show, in Cuba, major street protests erupt. People are angry about government misrule.
I do think that once you have this kind of explosion, you can't turn back the page of history.
And the heat wave in the Pacific Northwest was bad for humans. For marine life, the tragedy was evident on the shore.
The first thing I noticed was this sort of putrid, baking shellfish smell that really alerted me that something was terribly wrong.
An estimated 1 billion marine animals gone. I'm Marco Werman. Those stories and more today here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. This is The World. It is good to be with you today. In Cuba, an astonishing scene. Anti-government demonstrations. That was yesterday when thousands of protesters took to the streets in cities across Cuba. A rare moment in a nation that cracks down hard on dissent. In Bejucal, a town south of Havana, protesters cheered, Libertad, Libertad, Liberty, Liberty. Historian Lilian Guerra has written extensively about the politics of Cuba and has been following the protests from her home in Gainesville, Florida. The videos from yesterday, Lilian, look like protests you might see anywhere around the globe, but this is Cuba. How unusual is it for people to come out in the streets and voice their grievances on the island?
Really, there has been nothing like this since the first 3 days of January 1959, when another dictatorship was toppled, that of Batista, and that the new revolutionary government, not yet communist, led by Fidel Castro, was attempting to take power and very fearful at the time that the military might try to stage an interventionist or transitional government instead. So this is nothing like what we've seen before. And the extent, it's not just that Cuba doesn't have very many street protests. When we have street protests, they tend to be in Havana. They tend to be very small, and they're immediately repressed. Everybody is, you know, jailed, taken away, and whatever violence that is done to them is done behind closed doors. So this is different because you have the magnitude, you have the protests happening from Oriente, the far eastern province of Cuba, you know, all the way really to the end of the island. And I have to say that it is not just heartening to see the kind of courage that Cubans have, but what I see there is a tremendous degree of power that they feel now that they have to speak their voice.
So we heard the shouts of Libertad a moment ago. What do the protesters want? What are the issues?
I think that there are a number of sparks to this. There has been a lot of fuel over the course of the last year and a half as COVID has intensified already existing scarcities, has revealed the degree to which the government is unwilling to make any kinds of economic reforms that would broaden the access that Cubans have to the capitalist sector of the economy that is not controlled by the government. Children have been isolated at home as well. They haven't been able to attend school. So you have multi-generational conversations happening in the home, analyzing what's going on in the street because there have been very long ration lines.
So are Cubans dissatisfied with a few things that are not going right and basically asking their government to do better? Or do these protests suggest a wider dissatisfaction with the entire socialist system? What is your read?
Oh, I definitely think that what they're calling for is an end to the communist state. And I think that, you know, for at least the 27 years that I've been traveling and living in Cuba, I have seen that most Cubans, unless they're militants of the Communist Party, and only about 10% are, feel that they want a different government. They want multi-party elections, et cetera. They would love to have freedom of the press. They have sort of created it through social media, but they don't have it, you know? And I do think that the degree and tenor of these protests, the fact that people are openly calling for patria y vida, you know, life and fatherland, and denouncing the state as a dictatorship openly. These are things that we have never seen before, and we have never seen them last more than 2 to 3 minutes, literally. And this is extraordinary.
So Cuban President Miguel Díaz-Canel has labeled the protesters vulgar criminals. We know Cuba is known for putting dissidents in prison, and many of these protesters were arrested. Are those protesters now in danger, and where does this leave any semblance of a movement?
The problem here is that the Cuban state cannot put the finger on any one group, and so there is no organized opposition. These are protests that are not necessarily spontaneous, but that have gained credibility and ground and numbers, and so you can't jail everybody. What you can do is cut off their Wi-Fi and their internet and prevent them from broadcasting the videos of what is happening, and I think that that is something they did overnight. They will surely try to do it again. Those who are in prison, who knows what will happen to them? I mean, they are seen as anti-Cuban mercenaries of a foreign power, which is, of course, the United States. And it is utterly absurd to accuse them of being that. But this is the line that the Cuban state has taken for 60 years when it comes to its opponents and its critics.
Do you think the protests are going to continue? I mean, how deep is the desire for communism to end?
I have no doubt that they will continue. I don't know that they will be able to take this kind of scale because the Cuban state has massive resources allocated towards both uniformed, ununiformed security forces. So the repression will be dramatic, and it will continue parallel to whatever protests there might be, big or small. I do think that once you have this kind of explosion, you can't turn back the page of history. You march forward. And this is, I think, going to be clear to Cubans. I don't think that the Cuban state is suddenly going to reverse course, you know, and drop all of the positions that it very recently broadcast and took in its, latest Communist Party Congress. So as long as they're going to stick to non-negotiation of anything and one-party rule and a constitution that mandates loyalty to that one-party rule, we have a standoff between state and nation.
Today, President Biden said he supports the Cuban people and what he called their clarion call for freedom and relief. Is it too soon to discuss what this means for U.S.-Cuba relations?
Well, you know, I do think it's a little early. I'm thrilled that Biden has said something. I am fearful that people who would like to take advantage of the situation and who we can count among many Miami exiles are threatening to go to the island. And we had a rally led by the mayor of Miami yesterday in which that was precisely the chant and the call. I think that would be the worst possible outcome because then the Cuban government would be justified in its repression. Here are the mercenaries. We know them. They have faces and names. And so that can't be part of the scenario. I do think that Biden, you know, if he were to begin to plot a policy that we know about, that would be a great improvement on the sort of silence and stagnation that since the Trump administration that we have seen so far.
Lilian Guerra is a professor of history at the University of Florida, Gainesville, speaking with us about anti-government protests in Cuba. Professor Guerra, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Now to Brazil. Between COVID deaths and infections, police brutality, not to mention this weekend's loss to Argentina for the Copa America Championship, it has been a rough year for Brazil. One bright spot, though, its agricultural exports. Brazil has shipped record amounts of soy and other commodities. That has helped the country withstand the financial impacts of the pandemic, but not without consequences. As Michael Fox reports, growing all that soy is now taking a toll on small farming communities.
Brazilian researcher Flavio Oliveira knocks a stake into the ground in a forest in the southern Brazilian state of Paraná. She's a PhD candidate in environmental studies at UC Santa Cruz, and she's finishing her fieldwork. It's hot, but she's wearing long sleeves to keep off the flies. These are the ones that try to lay eggs in your skin. She ropes off several areas of 100 meters each and proceeds to identify everything inside. She finds Brazilian sassafras, a tall, thin tree that's actually under threat. Araucarias, with their strange upturned branches, hover over everything, like a transplant from some prehistoric era. I have to do a qualitative analysis of the area, says Oliveira. And there are many things I'm looking for. If there is animal poop, how much? If there are invasive plants, or what are the other types of trees and shrubs, and which are dominating, she says. For several years, she's been studying the health of forests inside traditional communities known as Faxinal. Some of them have been around for more than 100 years. They're found only in the countryside of the Brazilian state of Paraná. The residents often harvest pinon nuts or mate, the South American tea. They also raise pigs. But the most defining feature of the Faxinal communities is that they let their farm animals roam free on their communal lands. While Oliveira works, a horse and several pigs meander by. It's easy to miss them, they're so quiet. Researcher Oliveira says the Faxinal are a fascinating example of sustainable land use because they have intentionally preserved their forests as a feeding ground for their pigs and other animals.
So the system has been an ally for forest conservation in the region because the pigs need the forest, so the Faxinal needs the forest standing.
On the other side of the community, resident Tarcísio Maestris talks softly on the front porch of his wooden cabin, his wife beside him. He's a young leader of this Faxinal community known as Marcondes. Most of the families in Marcondes have been here since their ancestors emigrated from the Ukraine a century ago. But there's a problem. Soy, he says, is breaking their community apart. Our greatest threat today is the invasion of the monoculture of soy, says Maestris. People don't see our land as a territory and are instead privatizing the areas that were collective and negotiating to put in soy. It's ending our way of life. Maestris says the size of their communal land has shrunk to a sixth of what it once was. That's in part because of soy. Brazil outpaced the United States last year to become the largest soy-producing country in the world. Record exports are again expected this year. The country is looking to produce nearly 5 billion bushels. Décio Teixeira is the head of the Soy Producers Association in the nearby state of Rio Grande do Sul. He says he's been farming soy for 5 decades, and that the bean has been a huge catalyst for rural development around the country. Since the 1970s, he says, Brazil was practically built around soy. The bean is grown up and down the country. When I was reporting last year in the Amazon, I passed endless fields of soy along the highways outside the port city of Santarém. In town, there's a huge Cargill terminal where tankers are loaded with shipments of soy for export. More than 70% goes to China. Economists say record exports in soy and other commodities such as coffee, sugarcane, and paper pulp have helped keep Brazil afloat despite the pandemic. Agribusiness in Brazil makes up more than a quarter of the country's GDP, and soy is the biggest chunk of that. Teixeira says soy is the great engine of growth for Brazil, and every year production increases by at least 3%. Last year, we planted 94 million acres of land in Brazil with soy. This year, we hope to hit almost 100, he says. But that growth has a cost. On a late afternoon in the Faxinal community, I launched my drone from the forest where Oliveira was doing her field work. From above, looking west, two dirt roads wind through the forest. They're dotted by small ponds and clusters of houses. But in the other direction is a brown hillside, wiped clean of trees to make way for soy. The same image covers the landscape like a quilt extending toward the horizon. As Faxinal lands shrink, it becomes harder and harder for residents to make ends meet. Here's Oliveira again.
I walked through like the property of this one family, and there's this beautiful forest, a lot of forest. And he told me, like, I don't want to cut the forest down. I want to do something with this area. But if I don't have an economic return from whatever I'm doing with this area, I'm going to probably plant soybean.
Soy is not the only thing threatening these communities. Land grabbers and logging companies have long battled with small farmers over their resources. And there's the challenge of changing times. families age, kids move on, properties are sold. Many newcomers are looking for a country home or a quick profit. They plant soy or fence off communal land, blocking farm animals from the forests where they would normally wander. This makes it harder and harder for those trying to live the way their families have for generations. For The World, I'm Michael Fox in Florianópolis, Brazil.
You're with The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. Authorities in Haiti have arrested a third suspect with ties to the U.S. in the assassination last week of President Jovenel Moïse. The suspect, Christian Emmanuel Sanon, is a doctor who lives in Florida.
Christian Emmanuel Sanon, qui est maintenant sous contrôle la police.
At a press conference, Haitian police said Sanon was one of the masterminds of the assassination and was plotting to become president. The killing of President Moïse is just one of several crises Haiti is now facing. There is COVID, of course, with barely any vaccines in the country. Also, gang violence in the Haitian capital has forced more than 10,000 women and children to flee their homes in recent weeks. That's according to UNICEF representative Bruno Maïs in Port-au-Prince.
Since early June, we had an escalation of urban guerrilla warfare. New clashes between rival armed gangs erupted in some urban areas of the capital of Port-au-Prince. And these new clashes between rival armed gangs led to hundreds of houses being burned down or damaged. And we have over 15,000 women and children who are forced to flee their home due to acts of violence in and around Port-au-Prince.
You work primarily with women and children. Just how safe are they then from these rival armed gangs?
Thousands of them are trapped in so many areas and subsections in the city. So we are using the helicopter from Work Food Program to reach, for example, the displaced population who fled to Carrefour, to the commune of Carrefour. So we are using helicopter to avoid to pass through Martissan, because Fontamara and Martissan are still subject, even yesterday night, of heavy fighting among gangs. The road is blocked, and it's hampering transport of goods and population. So these armed groups are fighting in around territory which is corresponding to more than one third of the city. The situation was bad before the pandemic, got worse during the pandemic, and is now further deteriorating amidst the insecurity and gang violence.
It's really hard to imagine how terrifying all this gang violence is, especially for children in these urban neighborhoods. I mean, you talked about heavy fighting just last night. What does that look like for the women and children you're trying to help?
Well, there is no space for them in such kind of situation. Already thousands of women and children left the area where we have fighting between gangs, but some of them could not flee and are staying in so many subsections of communes in the city. They cannot go to the hospital easily. All livelihood activities are paralyzed. So we are really fearing the deterioration of the situation.
Bruno, take us, if you would, into the experience of one family that you've worked with, or the life of a single mother you've been working with, and the kind of uncertain situations they've been dealing with.
Well, I met several young mothers. One of them, she had to flee the first place where she was displaced following the fighting between then the police and the gangs, and she had to flee to the church of Saint-Yves. She delivered a young girl in a very, very difficult condition. She had to go for a C-section, but she's safe and the baby is safe. But the conditions are really difficult in the church Saint-Yves. It's not really a place where people can stay with dignity. It's not the appropriate site. But for the moment, the authorities cannot provide any other alternative.
If that's the kind of control these gangs have over the city, I mean, are your employees, is your staff with UNICEF able to move freely through the city?
Well, it's based on daily assessment. You know, you have around 95 different armed groups operating here in Haiti, and the route leading to the south is now mainly under control there by armed groups and blocked for a normal access for the population and the humanitarian community. So four departments of the South are now, I would say, isolated in a way because goods and people cannot transit anymore easily to Port-au-Prince. We are fearing basically that the lack of access to the population will cause a humanitarian crisis. Nearly one third of all children in Haiti, at least 1.5 million, are in need of humanitarian assistance. And so we are deeply concerned, UNICEF, about the further deterioration of the situation in this country.
Bruno Maes is the Haiti representative for UNICEF. He's been speaking with us from Port-au-Prince. Thank you very much, Bruno.
Thank you so much.
So what is it like to navigate daily life in Port-au-Prince lately? Daphne Charles is 35. She lives there and works with a nonprofit called HELP. That stands for Haitian Education and Leadership Program. Charles works to help young people get through college or get scholarships. Like many in Haiti, the news about the assassination of President Jovenel Moïse last week startled her.
Shocked, confused, overwhelmed. Things like that just don't happen anymore.
Charles has also felt shame.
I'm ashamed about what happened. When you see Haiti and you see the potentials that Haiti has and you see what Haiti can offer, like the culture, the music, our beaches. So you see all of that that we can offer to the world. But Haiti is always on the news for negative. And that's why, like, it's very, 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 very difficult to speak about it. Yeah.
Charles also sees what goes wrong in Haiti. Literacy rates are low, for example, and few make it to college. But as she says,
it's human rights to have access to quality education, and this needs to be addressed. And it's unfortunate that we are behind on that.
Civic education, too, and ethical government.
Sometimes we have leaders that are educated, talented, and skillful, but they are missing good moral values and ethics, you know, and then this leads them to just search for personal gain for themselves, their relatives, but they don't really act for others' interests or for the country interests.
Daphne remembers reading a book as a kid.
I think I was even in primary school. It's called J'aime Haïti. J'aime Haïti, that's French, but if you translate it in English, it would be I love Haiti. They were teaching you very simple things, you know, very simple things that you will just repeat. But some of these notions of values, they stayed with me until now.
At times, Daphne Charles also struggles to see Haiti without political unrest. She was born in 1986, the year then Haitian president Jean-Claude Duvalier was overthrown and forced to flee.
We never got a break. And then to the point that I'm like, I'm just breathing. Breathe in, breathe out. That's what it is. It's tiring.
She says many of her friends from her university days had no choice but to leave Haiti. Charles studied in the U.S. and says she's had many opportunities to live elsewhere. But Haiti is home.
Don't get me wrong. Leaving has crossed my mind every time. And then, you know, as I'm speaking to you, to be honest, I want a break.
That was Daphne Charles, who works with Haitian Education and Leadership Program, HELP, a nonprofit in Haiti. We'll be right back. You're with the world. Beijing is cracking down on feminist activists online. That very likely would have upset Chairman Mao.
The history of the Communist Party in China is actually very feminist.
And a video game turns 25.
It's me, Mario.
With its memorabilia fetching some serious coin, that's still ahead here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. We're a co-production of GBH Boston and PRX. We're still coming to terms with the extent of the damage from the recent heat wave in the Pacific Northwest. Hundreds of people died from the extreme temperatures. Out at sea, the death toll was also severe. Perhaps more than a billion, that's with a B, marine animals died from the heat. Marine biologist Alyssa Gaiman was tracking this from the University of British Columbia and the Hakai Institute in Vancouver. Describe the scene, if you could, Alyssa, on some of these beaches where a lot of dead animals washed up. What was going on?
Yes. So I live near the ocean. And on the day of this high heat wave event, I actually went down to go swimming because I was incredibly hot myself. And when I got there, the first thing I noticed was this sort of putrid baking shellfish smell that really alerted me that something was terribly wrong. I went out to investigate what was happening and I saw all these mussels just popped open. So an entire sort of bed wall of mussels were popped open, and mussels shouldn't be open during a low tide. They need to be closed, holding water in to survive those high heat events. But clearly it had just gotten too hot. I will admit that I still tried to go swimming. And as I got to go in the water, a dead crab floated past me. And that's when I just decided there was too much mortality on that beach for me really to swim.
That's really tragic. So mussels, a dead crab, but we're talking a billion marine animals dead. What kind of other species are we talking about? And how did you get to that figure, 1 billion?
Yeah, so it's a first estimate figure. And what we started with really was the mussels, because they're the most obvious mortality. You can see them immediately. One of the things about mussels is that they're foundation species. So as a mussel bed, what we can see are the mussels, but inside that bed, there's crabs, there's snails, there's sea stars around them. And then as you start to expand out into other habitats, and we've been hearing about shellfish loss. So clams were dying in the mud, and we're just beginning to understand the full extent of the mortality.
So a billion dead individual animals, that obviously has knock-on effects. What are the cascading impacts of so many dead animals on these ecosystems?
Yeah, so as I mentioned, mussels are foundation species. So there's the animals that live within them. There's the animals that eat them. So crabs really like to eat mussels. And then on top of that, mussels are actually filter feeders. So one mussel can filter up to 6 gallons of water a day. If you add that up to our estimate of a billion, that's a lot of filter feeding that is not happening. Filter feeders are incredibly important because they clear the water and they allow light penetration into the eelgrass beds. And the eelgrass beds are important habitats for all these animals that are important to human livelihoods.
So that was the next thing I was going to ask you. It's not just other animals, but people rely on these ecosystems for food. How are coastal communities affected and coping?
I know that there were large amounts of losses in the shellfish farms in the region, and they suggest that we've had devastating losses.
So, Alyssa, you study the relationship between coastal ecosystems and climate change. Is this an impact of climate change that you had been predicting?
This is a fundamental climate change issue, but this is much warmer than I was expecting and much sooner. I mean, we know that there will be an increase in the number and the frequency of these rare events, but this event was incredibly poorly timed for the animals in this system. So these are intertidal organisms. They live between the land and the sea. They experience high temperatures regularly. But this particular heat dome event happened at the exact wrong moment for them. It was the lowest tides of the year, so they're out of the water for the longest amount of time. And also the widest amount of area was available to be experiencing this incredible heat event. And these temperatures are well beyond anything that we had expected them to experience anytime soon. In some locations, we actually measured, so the mussels live on a rock and they're directly exposed to the sun. And some locations, the mussel in that sort of direct irradiance, the direct sunlight, would heat up to 120 degrees. And that's just well beyond what they can actually survive.
So this was unprecedented. I'm just wondering how it feels for you, Alyssa, on a personal level, to see so much death in an ecosystem that you study and care about.
Yeah, it's been incredibly depressing. I really love these ecosystems. I love working in these ecosystems. I love the animals that are there. And to see a mortality event of this kind just is incredibly sad.
I mean, it seems with the recent heat wave, salmon, for example, were able to be trucked to cooler holding pools, but that can't be a sustainable option for all animals moving ahead. If this is climate change induced, the solution is dealing obviously with climate change. Are there short-term fixes?
That's the hardest thing for these particular animals is, as there's really, this is where their habitat, this is where they live. And we're very concerned that, especially if these huge heat stress events become more frequent, that they won't be able to survive in these environments. And there isn't really a short-term fix.
Where have you been looking for hope in the last few days since this heat wave essentially kind of came to a close?
The one thing that brings me hope is that we know that these mussels, when they die of heat stress, or really know that they're going to die, they release a lot of larvae. I really hope that those larvae survive and are able to recruit back. And so we're hoping that they will be able to survive in the longer term, but that's yet to be seen.
Alyssa Gaiman is a marine biologist with the Hakai Institute. She's been speaking with us from Vancouver. Thank you very much, Alyssa.
Thank you.
Beijing is clamping down on social media accounts. That's meant that across China, some feminists and LGBTQ activists are being silenced, online anyway. From Shanghai, The World's Rebecca Kanther reports on why Beijing sees these particular groups as anti-China threats and how they continue to have a voice.
Back in April, Chinese activist Li Maizi saw another feminist being attacked online by nationalist trolls, and she felt she had to respond. After she posted, she found her Weibo account, that's China's version of Twitter, shut down.
What I can do is just watch. A lot of people say, you are trying to inside the state, divide our country. That is really, really, really absurd. So I still could see what other people post something that insult me, but I couldn't make any comments.
Li is used to this kind of attempt at silencing her. 6 years ago, she and four other women were detained for over a month for planning a protest against sexual harassment. They became known around the world as the Feminist Five. When feminist Liang Xiaowen had her account shut down, she was accused of posting discriminatory content.
They just outright decided that what I was doing was illegal. I didn't even have an opportunity to speak for myself. It's not fair at all because I don't understand at all what did I post that is illegal.
Liang is a lawyer based in the U.S., and so she reacted as any lawyer might. She sued. She says the courts should have 7 business days to accept her case. It's now been 3 months.
I can accept if I lose a case or if I win a case, but I don't think it's fair that the court is not even dealing with my case.
Gender equality was seen as important in the early days of China, says Leda Hong Fincher. Her book, Betraying Big Brother, documents feminism in the country.
The history of the Communist Party in China is actually very feminist. So the People's Republic of China was founded on the principle of gender equality, which is enshrined in the Constitution.
These days, Hong Fincher says that feminist and LGBTQ rights movements have broad appeal among young people in China for a different reason.
It's fundamentally about young people's desire to live the kind of life they want to lead. For most people, it's not about politics. It's about individual freedom. So that's a lot trickier for the Chinese government to handle.
Young people want to choose their own relationships and whether or not to have kids. Just last month, the government changed the birth policy to allow couples to have 3 children. But Chinese women's response was less than lukewarm.
Feminism is perceived to be such a threat by the Chinese government because it's not just an ideology. It actually is affecting their birth rates. The government sees it as contributing to the larger problem of the aging of the population and the shrinking of the workforce.
Hong Fincher says the recent attacks on feminist and LGBTQ activist accounts is about a fear of foreign influence, which is nothing new. Li Maizi and the rest of the Feminist Five were accused of this in 2015. Last month, Li Maizi says she attended a feminist cartooning workshop, but the owner of the shop where it was held was interrogated by police.
Once we finished our workshop, we destroyed every posters or meeting materials. So we tear them up and we drop them into different dustbins. That is a fact. If you want to do something, it's very risky. And you don't know whether the police will take those as evidence to try to convict someone.
As for the student groups whose accounts have just been scrubbed, they're still figuring out what to do next. I texted with a woman who used to run activities for her university's LGBTQ group. She asked not to use her name or her voice for fear of getting in trouble with her school. Here's what she texted. It's a real shame. We don't know if there's any legal action we can take. We didn't expect this to happen, so we didn't have a backup of all of our content. The most important thing we need to do right now is recover past articles and then post on a new account. She says they will apply to their school administration to start the club again in the fall, but she worries it will be banned. Prominent feminist Liu Ping says the situation is grim, but that activists are not giving up.
As long as they are not treated equally by the society, feminism will have its followers who will never give up that determination, not because we ourselves are strong, but because we have a very broad community.
And she says that will withstand the crackdown. For The World, I'm Rebecca Canther in Shanghai.
Tintin was one of the most popular European comic book characters of the 20th century and found, continues to find, fans around the globe. As you may know, the main character, Tintin, is a teenage reporter who, along with his dog Snowy, find themselves in various countries solving mysteries. From the 1920s to the 1980s, Belgian cartoonist Hergé, real name Georges Rémy, published 24 comic books about Tintin set in Peru, Morocco, Egypt, China, the U.S., and what was then the Soviet Union, but never in Bangladesh. Several months ago, R.J. Opu decided to fix that. Opu is a radio personality in Dhaka, the capital of Bangladesh. Opu, welcome to the show.
Hello, Marco. I'm really glad. This is amazing. This is absolutely amazing. I'm doing an interview with you, and it's about Tintin.
You've been a fan since you were a kid. What is it about Tintin that first captured your imagination when you were young and growing up in Bangladesh?
I grew up reading all those amazing books about detectives and adventure. When I got to know about Tintin and when I started reading it, I got amazed that this little kid with a dog solving the mysteries, it amazed me, literally amazed me. And I sometimes put myself in Tintin's shoe. I imagined myself as Tintin and I thought, what could I do if I was Tintin? I remember when I was a child, I was dying for a dog like Snowy. I wanted that, but it never happened, actually. So it's amazing. It blew my mind, actually.
So, Opu, you have now managed to get Tintin to Bangladesh. How and why did you do this?
That's pretty interesting, actually. When I was a child, I was always wondering why Tintin is not in Bangladesh. So I always wanted Tintin to be in Bangladesh, but it never happened. When I grew up and I got to know about Hergé and Tintin and its background story, I thought, if I can draw that, if I can do that, at least we can have an idea, what if Tintin came to Bangladesh? So what happened actually, 3 months back, I got infected by COVID. And I was isolated for 21 days in my house. So I have nothing to do. I was really upset, depressed. And all my doctors and friends, they all advised me, please stay positive, do stuff you want to do. So I thought, let's start drawing. One day I just thought, I am pretty confident I can draw Tintin. So I just drew Tintin in Dhaka in front of the National Parliament House of Bangladesh. And I posted it on my Facebook profile and everyone liked it. People started requesting me to get Tintin into their cities, their home and stuff. So I just kept going.
The Tintin in Dhaka in front of the National Assembly building, I mean, that was designed by architect Louis Kahn. I mean, these are really beautiful and I have to say proud depictions of Bangladesh.
Exactly.
To be clear, you're not creating whole new stories, though, just the cover art, right?
Exactly. It's just the cover arts, not the full stories.
So, Opu, I'm wondering if you had to create a storyline for Tintin in Cox's Bazaar, Tintin in Dhaka, what does your imagination tell you about how that adventure might go?
That's a very interesting thing. When I drew Tintin in Dhaka and I put Snowy in a leash, all the Tintin fans, they hated it. They said, oh, no, you can't do that. Snowy is a free dog. He's very intelligent. You don't have to put it in the leash and stuff. So my point was Dhaka is a very crowded city. People are all around you. You have cars and traffic jam and stuff. So I had to do that. You know that Snowy is very curious.
And rarely, rarely on a leash.
And he can run away. And so I put him on the leash because my first story would be Tintin losing Snowy in Dhaka and trying to find him.
A more realistic view of life in modern Bangladesh. You know, Opu, some volumes in the Tintin series have been deeply criticized for their colonial depictions of people who are not white, like Tintin in the Congo or Tintin in America.
Right.
Was that also in the back of your mind as something that needed correction?
When I grew up reading Tintin, I didn't understand that. But later on, when I got to know and understand, there are a few aspects that was back in my head, but not that much. Because I like the whole idea of Tintin, the brightness, the positiveness of that thing. So I always try to ignore that fact that there is some controversy, especially in Congo and Tintin in America.
You're more interested in the solving of crimes and the kind of justice for the right people.
Exactly, exactly.
So I've read that Tintin is really popular among Bengalis in Bangladesh, also in West Bengal and India. What is the story behind that? Is it simply the translations that came out in the 90s and 2000s?
Back in the 90s, the Bengali people and the Bengali kids, the only way they can entertain themselves when they're home is reading books, comic books, novels and stuff, those stuff. So at that time, there is no Bangla comics like this. There is no adventure-based Bangla comics. There is no cable TV. We don't have internet. So this was also a way to know about the Western culture or different cultures around the world. So that's why Tintin became a big hit in Bangladesh, actually. And there's this amazing fact that there are so many people out there who actually don't even realize that Tintin is not South Asian. It's so deep into our culture that people often accepts it as our own literature or culture. It's that much popular in our country. When I was a kid, I also thought that. He's one of us.
RJ Opu, real name Zahidul Haq, is a radio personality in Bangladesh and a huge fan of Tintin. You can see his fan-inspired cover art of Tintin in Bangladesh at theworld.org. Opu, thank you so much. It's great to meet you.
Thank you so much. Thank you so much.
You spend time with the world every weekday to hear voices and stories that connect you to places that might not be on your radar. That connection continues on social media. Join the conversation about stories that keep you thinking. Find our team of journalists on Twitter. Our handle is easy to remember. We are at The World. In a tense soccer match that went into extra time, Italy defeated England yesterday in a penalty shootout to become the European champions. Another shining moment for Italian soccer and yet another disappointment for England. For England, though, things quickly went from disappointing to downright ugly when scores of fans took to social media with racist slurs targeting England's players of color. Shaka Hislop is a former English Premier League soccer player, a goalkeeper. He's now the honorary president of the educational charity Show Racism the Red Card. Shaka, what was your reaction to how people responded online to England's loss yesterday?
As appalled as I wasn't all that surprised. Mind you, this isn't just about 120 minutes of football. This isn't just about England again feeling at a penalty shootout. This started the first game of the tournament when the players, as they've been doing over the last 12 months, took the knee before their first game and were roundly booed by England fans. The English Prime Minister, Boris Johnson, refused to condemn the players' booing. I felt that was the fuel to the fire, a fire that had been started quite some time ago. And then you see the result of it all playing out in real time after the disappointing loss. Disappointing from an England perspective, of course.
Yeah, in real time, just watching the Twitter light up, it was really, really sad. Remind us what players were targeted and why.
Well, specifically, it was the three black penalty takers, each of whom missed. Marcus Rashford, Jadon Sancho, and Bukayo Saka. And they failed. They missed. And it's heartbreaking for them on a professional level. And then on a personal level, to see the response of the fans, to see the abuse that they got on social media, to see the death threats that were aimed at them, at their families and members of their own community. It's unimaginable to somebody like me who's played this game, who loves this game for what it is, to imagine being in either of their shoes.
I mean, my heart goes out to these young guys. I mean, how do you deal with this as a player?
I don't know. I'll be very honest with you here, Marco. I simply do not know. And listen, many people in the black community say, and say publicly, that they love this country. They love the United Kingdom. They love England. But at times, it just doesn't feel like the country loves them back. And that, for me, speaks to the disappointment, speaks to the struggle that many of these black players feel, that they go out there, they give their all, they put, in many regards, their careers, and in this regard, their lives at stake. And they don't feel that they get the protection or recognition that that bravery deserves. And while we're struggling with trying to make sense of this issue, making sense of it has escaped so many of us for so long, keep in mind that the final penalty taker, Bukayo Saka, is 19 years old. As a 19-year-old, how do you shoulder this? Struggle to find an answer.
Shaka, tell us a little bit how you started Show Racism the Red Card. I know you had one experience of racism that had a particular impact on you.
Certainly. So Jed Gary, who is Show Racism in Red Card's CEO and was doing a lot of anti-racism work in the northeast of England, contacted me just as I joined Newcastle United back in 1995. And we just started having a discussion about his work and how I can support it. Not long after that, I was racially abused by a group of youths just outside St. James's Park. I was there late at night with my wife, just filling up my car with gas. And a group of youths come walking down the hill and start shouting racist abuse at me in the gas station. As they got closer, one of them recognized who I was and they started singing my name and wanting to come over for autographs. I left. But I was telling Jed about that story and about how I felt it spoke to the duality of who I was. From 50 yards away, I was a black man worthy of racist abuse. From 50 feet away, they wanted to sing my name and ask for autographs. And we used that experience and the standing of football players in England at the time to launch Show Racism the Red Card.
So what that story tells me, Shaka, is that soccer has that quality that can speak to racists and apparently soften them. But as we know, racism in soccer is connected to societal racism. How much can you change attitudes among soccer fans if socially we still have a big problem?
In addressing racism in society, we all have our roles to play in our spaces, whether that's in the arts, whether you're a musician or an artist, whether you dance, whether you go into your office every day and have conversations around the water cooler with your co-workers. We all have our responsibilities to play in our own specific spaces. That's how we address racism in the wider society. For me, that space is football. I've also felt that football is the perfect vehicle for moving these conversations forward. Where else can a young man from Trinidad and Tobago sit in a dressing room and be 5 feet away from somebody from Belgium, somebody from Colombia, somebody from Greece, somebody from Georgia? We all go out onto the field on a Saturday, regardless of those differences that we may have, and we work together to win the game. There's no more powerful message in life. So I will continue to focus on my space, but we each have our roles to play in each of our spaces.
Shaka Hislop is a former English Premier League soccer player and the honorary president of Show Racism the Red Card. Shaka, good to speak with you. Thanks very much for your thoughts.
Thanks for having me, Marco.
Remember this guy?
It's me, Mario. Hello.
The nostalgia for video game icon Super Mario has not worn off. It's been 25 years that the iconic 3D game Super Mario 64 burst onto the scene. It was the first title out of the gate for the new Nintendo 64 gaming console. A quarter century later, a single unopened copy of the game just sold for north of $1.5 million. That smashes a record for the most expensive video game ever at auction. That's valuation, I guess, so you earn this one, Mario. Play us through. The previous most expensive sale was an original Legend of Zelda cartridge that sold just 2 days earlier for about half the price, $870K. Now, if you're like me, you might be asking, what the... Yeah, the History Channel show Pawn Stars recently grappled with the same question when someone came in with another original Super Mario Brothers cartridge.
How much do you want for it?
It's a piece of history. It's something that's hard for me to part with, but I would sell it for $1 million.
$1 million?
Yep.
The Japanese gaming giant Nintendo recently re-released Super Mario 64 on its newer Switch gaming console. Cool in a retro way, not the real McCoy, though. The video game collectible firm WADA appraised the sealed copy that sold for $1.5 million with a near mint condition rating. You can bet that this cartridge won't be played. And that, it's the sound of victory. Mario getting the job done and winning the game.
And I'm Marco Werman. We'll see you back here tomorrow.